Hey guys, John Paulamy here, Actionable Intelligence. Today is Saturday, March 16th, and this is the weekly market update. The disclaimer: anything that you see or hear on this podcast or video is not to be taken as investment advice. I'm not a financial advisor. Please keep that in mind. Please do your own due diligence. It's your money, it's your responsibility. Okay, so first thing, I'm going to get into a responding to a comment that was made on one of the last videos. Typically, I respond in the show notes or the comments. You'll see me active in there occasionally. But this one, I haven't spoken too much lately about geopolitical things specific to the war in Ukraine. But I wanted to respond to this particular comment and also another comment this individual made about my forecast for an energy crisis this last winter in Europe and the fact that I got it wrong. Yes, I was wrong. There wasn't an energy crisis in Europe. But let's talk about, that's again, people make a lot of statements, or they don't look at the they don't deep dive it. And so this person was kind of exercised, I think. I don't know why, but they were. So let me respond to it. First, the comment, John, quick question. What happened to Ukraine's military falling apart like you said would happen? What happened to Europe freezing this winter? Where is this energy crisis you speak of? All of it has been fear-mongering horseshit, unquote. All right, let's talk about Ukraine first. I don't really want to talk about this too much because it riles people up. I do think it goes into my thinking because it has overall geopolitical consequences that far extend beyond, Russia or Ukraine. Okay, you're talking about a hegemonic power, the United States and its Atlanticist allies in Europe are in decline. I mean, if you can't see that, I see it differently if you don't see it that way. I see we're in decline. Go to any major city, look at our what we talk about in this country, what we, medically wise, fat, overweight population, diabetes epidemic, healthcare crisis, retirement crisis, wealth gap crisis, fentanyl crisis, housing crisis, da 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 da. This is not, Shangri-La. People say, well, all countries have problems. Yes, they do. But we are a declining power. We are looking outside of ourselves instead of inside. And so now, we have an emerging, I've talked about this before, over time in history, you have this view that, people that had the hegemon, that have the current hegemon in the US and Western Europe, or its vassals in Western Europe, don't want to see the rise of a Eurasian economic bloc, political economic bloc. Okay, because then they're cut out, and that would be the new hegemonic power, possibly. You can read, it's not me saying that. It's not some fantasy I made up. It's been talked about. That's what, you have to, what was Great Britain doing fighting in the Crimea War that back in the 1800s? That's what all that's about, the Great Game. Zbigniew Brzezinski talked about this, MacKinton Doctrine, all of these things feed into this. And again, I said I was going to make a video about it, but I really don't want the incoming fire. You either understand history, you're a well-read person and you understand what's going on, or you don't. Most people don't know what's going on. Okay. So let's talk about what's happening in the war in Ukraine. I'm not going to get into when it started or why it started. Let's talk about what's going on there. The person said that what happened to Ukraine's military fall, it is falling apart. The onus isn't on John to explain what happened to Ukraine's army. The onus is on the empire and the people and the hegemon that wanted this war with Russia to explain to me and others how they plan on winning it, because you're not going to win it. I have people in Ukraine. I have people in Russia. I know exactly what's going on all over Ukraine, okay? It's an economic shambles. A generation of people has left the country and will never come back. Young people, they've went to Europe. 2 million people in Poland. That just solved Poland's labor shortage. They're never coming back to Ukraine. Why? That's number one. Number two, The we're we're in, this war was started under the auspices of that, you know, the plan of the hegemon was that this was going to goad Russia into this. This is my view now. You can disagree. Russia took the bait, went in, and they would put all these sanctions on Russia. The Russian economy would collapse. The ruble would go to 200 to the dollar, and Putin would be taken out of power. And then they would go in and carve up Russia like they wanted to. You can read the, you know, that's been the plan for 100 years, for 200 years. Carve Russia up into these little statelets that could be controlled. For the resources, there's $100 trillion in resources there. It's inexhaustible, hasn't even been fully explored yet. Okay. So that didn't happen. Are the Russians executing the war perfectly from the beginning? No, they didn't. They went in with a shock force and they thought they would be able to shock the Ukrainian leadership into making a deal. And they did have a deal. A deal was getting made in Istanbul, if you remember, back in April of last year. And then Boris Johnson got on a plane and flew, you know, he was the messenger boy for the hegemon, and he flew to Kiev and told the Ukrainians, keep fighting. We'll supply you with weapons and money. You keep fighting. So they walked away from the table. And so the Russian force was not large enough. And we know the story, okay? They had to pull back in Kharkiv. They had the offensive there in the summer. That was good. The Ukrainians exploited that. They made great gains. The Russians pulled out of the West Bank of Kherson Oblast because of some supply issues. People in the hegemon, people in the Western media. That was a defeat for Russia. Call it what you want. Now we are where we are. Okay. How does Ukraine win this war? They have said their position is, the Ukrainian government is, they will not negotiate with Russia until all territories are taken back. That means Russia out of Donbass, out of Kharkiv province, out of Crimea. The onus isn't on me to tell you how that's going to happen. You need to tell me how that's going to happen. How is that going to happen? You know, the Ukrainians were trained for 8 or 9 years and had a NATO level capable army close to. Okay. That army was destroyed in the first 6 months of the war. Okay. What was destroyed during that? All of your weapons, Soviet era weapons, a lot of your air defense, your air force, your navy, those are all gone. Not only is that gone, your cadre of trained non-commissioned officers, your sergeants, and your junior officers that lead the men in the field, they're gone. They don't exist. They're dead or wounded, incapable of combat. And so now you've replaced that with a second army. You've brought a lot of mercenaries in. There's a lot of Polish people fighting in there. There's people from other countries, the Romanians, other folks, United States, UK people. Okay. And then that army was destroyed. Okay. And so what are you left with? You're left with constantly reconstituting during the fighting, okay? So how do you recreate the cadre of leadership in the field, okay? Where do you get the troops? You give them even just a boot camp and send them to the field into combat. You don't have a cadre of combat veterans that can pass on knowledge because people are liquidated. You know, even the New York Times and the Washington Post are admitting this now. They just had a commander that was relieved because he said all 500 guys under his command have been totally turned over. They've either been killed or wounded. It's all new guys. He's the only guy in his command that has combat experience. And so that's important. I think it's important. I was in the military. You have to have trained personnel. The other problem is that the hegemon didn't count on having a long, prolonged war either. They thought that the sanctions would cause a collapse in the Russian economy, which would lead to a political change in Russia, which would lead to a settlement that would be positive for the empire. That didn't happen. And now we find out that the Russians have the capability, their military industrial complex is set up for industrial scale war, and the West is not. And so we cannot supply enough weapons or ammunition to these people in Ukraine. What we're giving them is a hodgepodge of weapons that don't match, that are incompatible. So you tell me, okay, this is about logistics, okay? This is about compatibility. So if you're handing somebody some French tanks and some infantry fighting vehicles from this country and that country and this country, how do you maintain the stuff in the field? This stuff breaks down like you wouldn't believe, okay? How do you maintain it? Where do you get the parts? Where's the compatibility? How do you do the training for all this? You can't just give somebody a 3-week tank class and then they can go into combat and fight, you know, effectively. That's just not reality. You can make that, and if you make that argument that it's possible just to have these quick training programs and then send people into combat and expect them to be effective, it's not possible. That means you don't really know anything about the military. And so the Russians have stated what the SMO, the Special Military Operations goal are: demilitarization. That's what they're doing. The West has a view that you're not successful on the battlefield unless you're taking territory, because that's what we're used to seeing. We were spoiled by the Gulf War, this big armored thrust into Iraq and everybody throwing their weapons down. And we were taking, you know, things over in, you know, a couple weeks. Well, that's not the scale of the warfare or the type of warfare that's going on here. And so and people say, well, that's an excuse. It's taking them so long to do this, taking them so long to do that. Look, I'm not in the Ministry of Defense. I don't know what the tactics are, what the strategic situation is, but all they have to do is sit there and keep doing what they're doing. Time is on the side of the Russians, not the Ukrainians. They're out of people. They're out of weapons. And guess what? People in the West are getting tired of this. They're sick of it. You're getting ready to go into a massive recession now. You're getting ready to go into all these banking crises, and people are not going to be interested in sending billions and billions and billions of dollars to Ukraine. People are already sick of it. You can see it in the polls, okay? And so the plug's going to get pulled. So the last throw of the dice, supposedly, is supposed to be the spring offensive in Zaporozhye region, where the Ukrainians are going to make this massive thrust. They've been husbanding, as we've been told, they've been husbanding all their best soldiers, their best equipment, and then they're going to unleash it and make the strike towards Mariupol or Melitopol and cut Zaporozhye in half, cut the land bridge between Russia and Crimea, take out the Kerch Bridge, isolate Crimea, and have this tremendous victory. I'm not saying it's not possible. Anything's possible. I don't know what they plan on doing. They're going to, I've heard all kinds of things, but why would you tell everybody that? Does that make sense to anyone that you're just going to announce how you're going to do this and when you're going to do it? Maybe there's going to be this massive thrust into Kharkiv region up by Kremenia, and they're going to sweep behind the Russian lines and down and cut everybody up. Maybe that's what they're going to do. I don't know. I do know that Russia has a 10 to, depending on who you want to listen to, and even the West admits that, 8 to 1 to 10 to 1 tube and barreled artillery advantage the Russians have. They're not out of ammunition. They are constantly, you can anecdotally listen to, even in people in the West and the media are saying that. So the Ukrainians don't have the ability to respond. Most of the casualties on the battlefield are from artillery. Okay. We already had one of the, I've already heard Ukrainian higher level officers say that, 70 to 80% of their casualties are artillery, due to artillery, that many of the soldiers don't even see a Russian soldier when they're wounded. Russians have a advantage with their missile and aerospace forces, okay? They've been wearing down the Ukrainian air defense system. And the industrial capacity of Russia now is on a wartime footing. And the West is, I've seen reports that if the West wanted to gear up to supply the amount of artillery shells, it would take 3 to 5 years. This thing will be over by then. And so if you are measuring this by territory taken, then I guess you have an argument. If you measure this by casualties and by what's trying to be achieved strategically, what's trying to be achieved strategically is now that the situation is such that there will be no negotiation. What I think will happen is like happens in World War One or in the Civil War. The Confederacy was just outmanned and outgunned. And the North had more logistics, and the Confederacy just couldn't continue. It just was too worn out and tired to continue. So they had to surrender. Same thing happened to the Germans in World War One in 1918. They're just exhausted. Okay. And when the Americans entered the war, it was too much. It was enough to tip it. And so it's the same situation. This will continue until they just simply cannot continue any longer. And then, once you get past, say, this Bakhmut, Kramatorsk, Slavyansk line, the so-called Zelensky line. I mean, it's open territory to the Dnieper River. And, you know, who's going to stop, you know, is there going to be an offensive? I don't know. I'm not in the military defense. I don't, or Ministry of Defense of the Russian Federation. I don't know what they have planned, but they just can continue doing what they're doing. You know, if you create a pocket like in Bakhmut and the Ukrainian military just shoves more and more people in there and you just liquidate them with your artillery advantage, I mean, that's winning. That's demilitarization of Ukraine. Once they become fully exhausted and the U.S. and the West cuts the money off, which will happen eventually because this won't continue ad infinitum, simply won't be able to, then the Ukrainian political structure will collapse. The Russians will put a settlement to somebody that's in power in Kiev and they will sign it. Terms will be dictated to Ukraine. And then there'll have to be some type, and those terms will be the demilitarization, the fact that they'll agree not to join NATO, there'll be a pro-Russian government probably instituted, more than likely, and then how they denazify the country. That's what the special military operation goals are. And so I don't, you know, have the Russians executed this perfectly? Absolutely not. Does anybody, you know, I read an article about the Gulf War, the logistics and stuff that happened, even with our forces, the amount of vehicles that broke down and all the problems they had logistically and things like that. You know, I remember when we saw articles where people were bagging on the Russians because Russian people were donating funds for drones because the Russians didn't have enough drones in the field. Well, it's the same thing during the Gulf War. I remember taking up collections and people donating money so guys could buy the proper body armor because they weren't supplied with proper body armor. If you were in the war, you know that, if you remember. That's just one example. So nothing goes by the numbers for anyone during any military, large-scale military operation. So on that particular point, the onus isn't on me to explain how the Russians are going to win because the goals are being met. The onus is on people that support Ukraine or think Ukraine is going to win telling me how Ukraine's going to win. Because winning to them so far is they have said they're not going to negotiate with the Russians until all Russian troops are expelled from Ukrainian territory, including Crimea. I don't understand how that's going to happen. Second thing, what happened to Europe freezing this winter? It was one of the warmest winters in history. They got lucky. Not only that, they shut a lot of industry down that was being fueled by natural gas. Not only that, there is energy crisis. It was transferred because what happened was the Europeans basically spent €500 billion buying every LNG cargo they could find and switching to coal wherever they could to get past the situation that they had. Now, are you telling me that they're going to, that's the energy policy for the EU? Just hope that we have warm winters going forward? Or, you know, is part of the policy deindustrialization? Because you're deindustrializing a large part of the place. We've talked about how many companies here, there, and everywhere were shutting down. Now, some of them have restarted, but this problem isn't solved. And if your goal was climate change and CO2 emissions, well, switching to coal doesn't fix that. So you bought yourself a year. Okay. The energy crisis was present. It was just present in places like Pakistan and Bangladesh and these countries because they were priced out of these cargoes. And so what we have here, I think, in this particular person is don't fall into this trap, inability to think beyond the first level. Because it didn't, you know, that doesn't excuse that I was wrong on the timelines. That doesn't mean I'm ultimately wrong. That doesn't mean, you know, when you're analyzing things, you're not going to be 100% correct. If I was 100% correct, I mean, forget about it. I'd be the ruler of the world. No one can 100% forecast with certainty what's going to happen. If you think that, then that's begets a problem already. You're not really understanding how probabilities and forecasting works. There's an infinite amount of unknowns that can come in, okay? And so what we do is we look at it for example, with this energy thing, and we say, okay, well, the view, if we would have had a normal winter, this is what we were forecasting. We didn't have that. So the things that we forecasted didn't happen. But does that mean that the problem solved, or just get pushed to the next year? And that's my suggestion. The world's still in an energy crisis. The world still doesn't have enough molecules. If you look at it from the whole world, yeah, we were wrong in the EU because they had a warm winter and they shut down a bunch of industry. Is that positive for the EU? So when, again, as we constantly take in new information, we have to adjust, you know, the probabilities, we have to adjust the forecast. That's what a rational thinking person would do. Okay. We don't stick to the same forecast when things change. And I don't understand why, you know, some people, again, this is, I don't know this person, you know, maybe they went all in on natural gas based on what John said. You shouldn't do that. That was your first mistake if that's what you did. Now you're mad because it didn't happen because, you know, again, we have the disclaimer at the start. Nothing here is investment advice. This is just a guy on the internet saying things. But I would suggest that we probably get it more right than we get it wrong. And the other thing that we do here is we take you to the second and third level thinking. Sit and think about these things and what are the probabilities of this, that happening. Now, we don't just give you the superficial CNBC 2-minute television answer. So I'm sorry that I don't know why this guy's mad, but that's kind of my view on those two things. Take it or leave it. Doesn't really matter to me. Okay. More on, you know, fractional reserve banking and the bank failures. I saw this kind of parse this, like I'm on this email list for the Steve Blumenthal. He's pretty good. I've been following him for like 10 years. This was a, off his recent email, I kind of shortened out and edited it a little bit, but just to give you a sense that to remind folks of how fractional reserve banking works and why it's a problem, why it can become a problem. Now, I don't agree with fractional reserve banking. I don't agree with the Federal Reserve, but I'm not naive either. Doesn't matter what I think or what I believe is correct. It matters what's really happening in the real world. Okay. So how do these banks get in trouble? Well, they make money by paying you interest. This is very, very general and superficial. This is not exactly how the banking system works. This just gives you an idea, if you didn't already know, kind of how things work, pretty much how they work from a high level. So the banks take in deposits. They don't pay anything on those deposits. So we've had years of low interest rates. That's why people are shifting into money market funds and to T-bills. But if they're paying you 0.5% or 0.25%, and then they loan it out, they can loan money out at 10-to-1 leverage. This is what fractional reserve banking is. The Fed sets that requirement of how much leverage they can use. And so when they take in a dollar, they can loan out $10. That's how they create money. Okay, that's why banks create most of the money. So it says here, for approximately every dollar on deposit, they are allowed to lend out 10. They pay you 0.5% on your deposit and loan it at 2.5%. The net interest margin, that's what NIM stands for, spread in this example is 2%. They make the spread multiplied by 10, 20%. It's good business, see? You loan, take in basically free money and loan it out at 2% and lever it up 10-to-1. So you're basically a hedge fund. So what ends up happening is if you get in a situation where you don't have enough qualified buyers or borrowers, what can happen? Can't find enough people willing to borrow? The bank invests some of the money in mortgage securities, treasury bills, notes, and bonds. Now remember, a lot of people don't know the distinction on treasury securities. 0-to-1 year are treasury bills. Okay, that's mostly what's in money market funds that stay at a fixed value of a dollar per share. Okay, because they're so short term, interest rates don't typically fluctuate enough to cause them to change in value over that year. Okay, that's pretty typical most of the time. Then you go from like two to like 5 years, and then there's sometimes they issued some securities between 5 and 10 years. Those are notes, okay? Now those can be more volatile because over a 2 to 5 year period, rates can go up and down, which can affect the price of the treasury bond. Remember, if interest rates go up, the value of the bond goes down. Conversely, if rates go down, values of bonds go up. A lot of people don't understand that. Then you get into treasury bonds, 10-year securities, 30-year securities, zero coupons, things like that. They are exposed to the most interest rate risk because 10 years out, you have no idea how much interest rates are going to fluctuate. So they are very, very correlated. And so basically, what Silicon Valley Bank does, they operate like a highly leveraged hedge fund. They bought a lot of mortgage securities, treasury. I don't know all the duration that they had, but it was sufficient for them that as rates were increased massively by the Fed to deal with this inflation that they helped create, the bank did not hedge that interest rate risk. Now, this is where it gets complicated. I'm not going to tell you, I don't even know how that works, but it is possible, and a lot of people do this, that if you have duration risk far out, like again, if you're holding 2 and 5 year notes, 10 and 30 year bonds, you're going to hedge the interest rate risk because you don't want rates to go up massively and then your bond portfolio goes down in value, and now you have a paper loss. Now again, depending on what the regulations are, because they're treasury securities, whether you have to mark to market and report that loss, that's where you can get in problems. So the problem here is that Silicon Valley people told, I guess there was issues around some questions about the bank's balance sheet because of all these government securities and their value going down. People started taking their deposits out. They had to sell the securities at a loss. Now you have to mark the loss to market, and then you get a self-reinforcing, basically got a bank run, okay? And so again, I'm not in favor of fractional reserve banking. I'm not in favor of the Federal Reserve and the central planning that goes on there, and this idea that this group of PhD economists can, regulate inflation and employment rates by using the Fed funds rate. It's Soviet Gauss plan on steroids. It doesn't work. At least at Gauss plan, they had PhDs like, trying to figure out every little facet of production for every little nook and cranny of the Soviet economy. Here, they just use a 10-pound maul to kill flies in a house, and that's why you have all these holes in the drywall. Use a fly swatter. You don't use a 10-pound maul, but that's the only tool they have, so that's what they use. It's not the only tool, but it's the main tool. And so, it doesn't matter what I think. It doesn't matter what I think is right or wrong. I mean, the bankers control the economy. This system is not going to go away because it's very profitable. Okay, it's very lucrative. As long as everything stays calm and confidence stays in the system, it's very lucrative. It's when you get these upsets and everything starts going off the rails. Again, we talked about this before over the last year. What did we think the catalyst was going to be? We didn't know exactly. The last financial crisis in 2008 was because of mortgages and fraudulent mortgages and a real estate bubble. It's not going to be the same thing every time. And so now we're in the situation where we have, a banking crisis being caused by rates going up too quick by the Federal Reserve that contributed greatly to the creation of the inflation they're now fighting. So you see where I get aggravated and exercised because this is just more nonsense on top of more nonsense. So, I don't know the extent of the bank runs that are going to happen. I wasn't really given a lot of comfort to Mrs. Yellen saying that only banks that they thought were systemic would be helped. I don't know if that was a slip of the tongue or if that's policy. I don't know. But I do know that a lot of regional banks, anecdotally, you see all over FinTwit, people are pulling their money out and going to the big major money center banks, JP Morgan, Wells Fargo, Chase. I mean, the big four or five banks. As a matter of fact, there was somebody on Twitter said they pulled their money out of one of the banks, and they were told by, I think it was Chase or maybe it was JP Morgan, it's a 3 week wait just to get a new account now, because so many people now are doing that. Maybe that's what the Federal Reserve and the government wants. Maybe there's too many small banks in the country, and they want, like they have in Canada, where I think they only have like five major banks. It's easier to control. And the major banks would like that because that's more market share for them. Remember, the Federal Reserve is controlled and run by the bankers. I mean, this is not conspiracy theory, guys. I mean, the people rotate between the banking system, jobs in the banking system and in investment houses and the Federal Reserve. I mean, if you can't see how rigged it is, I can't help you. You're beyond help if you think this is how it's supposed to be. Again, it doesn't matter what you want, it only matters what reality is. So that's what we have to do. So again, we're in a situation where it's going to be inflate or die. So I look at it as kind of a binary outcome. What is going to happen? They're going to continue, telling you the economics populist view. Well, yes, we're going to continue. We have to get inflation under control because inflation is detrimental to the working class and middle class. And that's what we're all about. And we have this long-term target for 2%. So we're going to look at the data that's coming in and we're going to adjust accordingly. And we have the tools to deal with any of these crises that come along. That's total hogwash. They raise rates until stuff starts breaking, and then they reverse course and they will print as much money. They will expand the balance sheet as quickly. I mean, the balance sheet's up 300 billion this last week. And you get these arguments on Twitter. Well, that's just temporary. That's just a temporary mechanism until everything gets stabilized. Well, if they're going to continue raising rates, things are going to continue to break. Again, I take you back to what Felix Zuloff said. He thought that it would be possible that by the end of this decade, the balance sheet would go, to $30 or $40 trillion. I can see that happening easily. We don't know the extent. We know we have Credit Suisse right now. People are meeting in Switzerland. The regulators there and the government want UBS and S Credit Suisse to merge. Neither one of them wants to, and so we don't know what the outcome of that is. And what's the knock-on effects of a major bank, international bank like Credit Suisse, going bankrupt? Who are the counterparties for all the nonsense that they've got going on? Do we even know how deep the hole is there or in any of these banks? So that's why I say inflate or die. That's what they're going to end up doing. They're going to end up, when things break sufficiently, which they probably haven't yet, when they break sufficiently, and I don't know what that will be. I mean, I see that corporate bond spreads are starting to go up now. Again, if we're heading for a recession in the US, and we have all these zombie companies. Again, the economy doesn't work at 5% interest rates, 6% interest rates, 7% interest rates. It's too indebted. The cash flows are not sufficient to service the debt. A lot of, when you were at those super low rates for so long, a lot of companies, projects, businesses that should have never existed came into existence. And now they can't survive because they need constant inflows of capital, and they're not getting it now. Everybody's pulling back. So again, people keep asking me, well, what are you doing? I'm not doing anything. I'm not buying anything. This is not the time to buy anything. This is the time to, like I said, know what you own, okay? Because I can't forecast everything 100%. I don't know exactly. Yes, I still hold uranium shares. I still hold some oil stocks. I still have some of these things, but I have a large portion of my money in T-bills. I keep saying that for weeks and weeks. Go to Treasury Direct and buy T-bills. You can just roll them over. You're getting, 4 or 5% depending. Don't buy bonds. Buy the bills. You can buy them every week. They have an auction. You can get 4 week bills and just roll them. You won't get the same interest rate if you go out a year, but you want to be able to get your money back. Or go find a money market fund that specifically has low fees, that specifically invests in treasury, so you can get your money the next day if you want to. That's my suggestion. I just go directly to the treasury. Then I don't have any risk. I don't have to deal with a counterparty. Okay? Because you don't know what's going to happen. So this is Ray Dalio. This, again, Steve Blumenthal was quoting him, so I grabbed this quote. He's talking about what happens with these credit and debt cycles that basically go through short-term cycles of about 5 to 7 years, and then ultimately a big flush every 75 years or so. So let me read this quote. I think that is a very classic event in the very classic bubble bursting part of the short-term debt cycle, which lasts about 7 years, give or take about three, in which the tight money to curtail credit growth and inflation leads to a self-reinforcing debt credit contraction that takes place via a domino falling-like contagion process that continues until the central banks create easy money that negates the debt credit contraction. Again, inflate or die. Thus, producing more new credit and debt, which creates the seeds for the next big debt problem until these short-term cycles build up the debt assets and liabilities to the point that they are unsustainable and the whole thing collapses in a debt restructuring and debt monetization. Debt monetization. Debt monetization. Which typically happens once every 75 years, give or take 25 years. So I'm not interested in what Mr. Powell or Ms. Yellen says in front of Congress. That's just all claptrap for the news media to make. This is a confidence game. You know, con game means confidence game. They're running a confidence game. They're loaning money out. They've allowed banks, this is how the banking system works, to loan a $10 for every dollar they take in. And the Treasury and the Fed were happy to have these banks buying Treasury securities because nobody else is going to buy them, not with the Treasury debt that was coming out, forecasted, the vomiting out from the Treasury of $1 trillion a year, and then we talked about last week, having to roll a third of the national debt in the next year. Who else is going to buy this garbage? So, again, we're not into the monetization stage yet. That's where I think we're heading. So it's just stay in cash, because when we will go into this monetization, that's going to be inflate or die. You either inflate and monetize all this and call it whatever you want, call it yield curve control, call it QE, call it whatever you like, or you have a deflationary depression that will lead to a bloody revolution. Those are your two choices. That's not hyperbole. That's your choices. And that's where you're at now. You're past what Dalio's saying, is that you are past the 7 year short-term cycle that can usually be papered over. You're at the once every 75 year event. And that's why you see people saying stuff like developed markets will become emerging markets will become frontier markets will become non-existent. As Luke Groman said on Wealthion this week, he was interviewed, or maybe it was Macro Voices, I don't remember. I like listening to him. A lot of people think he's a nut, but I think he's pretty well thought out argument. What's their other option? Okay. People now are continuing to pull money out of these smaller banks. So we're going to see more, the possibility of more and more of them. Not only that, if the Fed continues to raise rates, things are going to continue to break. And so the argument is, well, they have to get inflation under control, John. Well, I mean, you're going to have what Luke Groman said, the Argentinization of the U.S. It's going to become like Argentina or Turkey, where, you know, you're just going to have this systemic higher rates of inflation over time. And that gets into the politics of the United States. Where are you going to cut the budget? There's no appetite in anybody in Congress anymore that I have seen to cut spending or to rein in the spending. So you have structural $1 trillion deficits that get added to the debt every year. Now you're going into a recession, so your tax revenues go down and your automatic spending goes up. You just laid out an 8.7% increase in Social Security payments to people for cost of living. You see how this works? Defense spending's up. Okay. $800 billion. You can't afford all this. And I went through that last week. I'm not going to go through it again. This is where you're at. So you're just going to take the medicine and do what's required, which is cut federal spending probably by 80%. That's not politically, again, I've said this before. Let me just make it cut to the chase. The things that need to be done to fix this are not politically possible. Okay, they're simply not politically possible. And the things that are politically possible are not sufficient to fix it. So you're on Mr. Toad's wild ride. I don't know if you've been to Disney World. Somebody used this analogy. I thought it was perfect. If you go to Disney World or Disneyland, I think they have it, Mr. Toad's wild ride. You're in this cart. It's a car, and you're going through this like insane guy's mind or whatever it is, and all this wacko stuff happens. And you're in a car, and it has a steering wheel. But once the doors open and you go into the wild ride, you realize that there's the steering wheel doesn't steer you. You're on a track. You're not steering anything. You can spin the thing like a top. It doesn't affect the steering. And that's what this is. We're on Mr. Powell's wild ride, and nothing can be done to fix this. And so my view is that we end up at some type of debt monetization, yield curve control. Just look at what, like I said, what these other throughout history, what they've done, and what benefits from this. Well, hard assets. That's where we end up. And, we'll see. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe they've contained this, and Mr. Powell will be able to raise rates, and he'll slowly guide the economy in to a soft landing. Rates will come down, or inflation rates will come down close to 2%. He'll declare victory. He'll be hero of the world. What do you think the possibility of that actually happening is? I don't give it. It's anything's possible. I don't give it a high probability. The probability is that if they continue to, even if they don't even continue to raise rates at this point, you as these legacy rate increases start to flow through the economy, more and more stuff's breaking. And so they'll be forced into doing what they always do in the end, which is not deal with fractional reserve banking, not get rid of the Fed, not let the market set rates, which is what you should do. But, you know, you get all these arguments. Well, John, you know, we have to save the banks because the average little guy. Hey, look, man, you should make a bank responsible. The bankers that are running it as part of their charter, they're personally responsible. You're going to go to prison. You have to put your own capital into this. And so if your own capital is at risk and you can go to jail because you want to run the thing like a hedge fund instead of just making loans to, you know, people, prudent loans, instead of being greedy that you have to pay a personal price, then I think you would attract the right type of people to the banking sector. Now, you wouldn't have the kind of boom times that you have, but then you wouldn't have, you would have busts, but they would be short. But these are all theoretical discussions that aren't ever going to happen. This is the way it is because this is the way that the elite and the people that run things want things, okay? They want the profits, okay? They want the profits privatized, and they want the problems and the fixes socialized. And you're just along for the ride. You have no power. You think voting's going to change this. I've been saying this for years. I chuckle. I tell people straight to their face, this is not fixed by voting. Voting doesn't fix this. Okay, moving on. So this is what happened last week. This is the two-year U.S. bond yield going back to 1996, just fluctuations. And you see that previous crisis, the interest rate that collapses on the bond. Why? Because people put money into these bonds as a safe haven. They run to this as a safe haven. It forces the price of the bonds up and the yield down, okay? And so that always happens at these 9/11 was a crisis, Lehman collapse, COVID, and now the biggest, you know, drop in rates in a week that we've ever seen. And so this is another reason why, you know, you're having all this dislocation across these markets, including like the energy markets, okay? You know, you have the oil market dropping because you had people long oil, okay, in futures for inflation hedges. And then you have people that were short, you know, these bonds. And then when everybody runs to the bonds for safety, okay, people that were short or whatever, money's coming out of everything else. And then people, you know, all these other, you get all these dislocations in it through these markets. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, I'm forecasting a recession in the US that's going to affect oil demand. Yeah. But should we have the kind of swings that we're seeing in markets? All of a sudden people just woke up last week and then oil's down like it is. Okay. Well, I mean, I think a lot of it has to do with futures markets and intermarket relationships. And when you see these types of dislocations, it's not just isolated just to this one market. As you have everybody running towards the perceived safety of treasury securities, which if you stay on the short end, you're probably going to be okay. This is what happens, right? You get the prices shoot up and the yield goes down, and that has reverberations as people close out other positions, right? So they have to sell these other positions and they're moving into this. Everybody starts panicking. This is what you're experiencing. So you're seeing, you know, you're in a storm now, and I don't know where the rogue waves are coming from. I'm not that smart. I can't, but I can tell you, just like, you know, when I was in the Navy, we'd be heading into these storms. You just, what they call, rig for heavy weather. Okay. You tie things down and you prepare, and stuff still, you don't catch everything, and stuff breaks loose, or you forgot something, it goes flying across the space. So, again, it's not the time to be bold in these markets. It's time to hunker down, ride through, knowing that in the end, we're going to end up in a situation that's going to provide rocket fuel for the things that we're interested in, i.e. hard assets. Okay, this is the Philly Fed Manufacturing Business Outlook. It's a diffusion index. Anyways, I wanted to show this because these gray areas are recessions. This goes back to 1970, so you see all these recessions. What do you notice is that this index always goes down massively during the recessions. Look where we're at. So the idea that we're going to have a, this thing's 8 for 8 on recession calls. I mean, we're probably already in a recession. Okay, how bad it's going to be, I don't know. When is the Fed going to reverse? I don't know. They are going to eventually. Okay. And you can see how low it gets. We're only about half, you know, typically it drops anywhere between 25, minus 25 and minus 50. We're just at minus 25. So we're heading, it's not going to be a soft landing. Okay. And people say, well, employment, I mean, all this nonsense on CNBC, this is to keep, you know, people from panicking. Okay. They're always going to put the bright picture on it. Well, you know, there's a shortage of people to work. And this all may be true, but that's not going, you know, demand is going to go down sufficiently. And people, you know, employment's always a lagging indicator, guys. It's not a leading indicator. If you look at the leading economic indicators, which are also pretty realistic or pretty good at forecasting recessions, they're all forecasting a recession. So if you're just going to hang your hat on, and, you know, we don't have enough dishwashers, well, who's going to be going to restaurants when they lose their job? I mean, I can make, so this is where we're heading. The point I'm trying to make is we're closer to the end of the rate increases than we are to the beginning. Okay. Everything's lining up, and, you know, they're, I don't know what they're going to call it, QE, like I said, what they're going to call it, but, you know, they're, you already see, they've already cut back on, you know, we went from 50 to 25 basis point cut increases. People are saying, well, they could still do 50. I mean, if they did 50 at this next meeting, I think next week, the market would collapse. They'll probably do 25 and it'd be done. Okay. I don't know. I'm not a forecaster. We'll see. Maybe they will do 50. Maybe they won't. They'll do nothing. Maybe they'll hold and say that they're going to watch data come in. I don't know what they're going to do, but they got themselves in a real jackpot now. And all the data points now are showing that, you know, we're heading for a recession. So I want to talk about Kazatomprom. This is the uranium miner, state mining company in Kazakhstan. They reported their 2022 yearly results, which were all good. I mean, you have revenue up 45%. Cash flow was up. Everything's up. Cash flow was up 139%. Debt was down. I mean, everything's going the right direction. The stock got nailed. Why? Well, their forecasts for next year are not good. For this year are not good. I mean, they're going to have lower production. Their costs are going to go up. And so, again, what I wanted to show is, you know, this is a company that can be actually analyzed as an investment. Again, a lot of people now are upset in the uranium market. A lot of people that don't know that they're speculators. They thought they were investors, but they're speculators, and they don't understand speculation. There's only, again, I'm going to say this again. There's only two investable, in my mind, at least right now, two investable companies in the uranium space, and that's Cameco and Kazatomprom. Why? Because they're the only companies that are real businesses. The rest of these things are on a hope and a prayer or trying to build a mine. And so those type of speculations, those burning matches, what do I mean by a burning match? I have to explain this to people over and over and over. Every other company in the uranium space, except for Kazatomprom and Cameco, are not investments. They are speculations. You're speculating that the company is going to find a resource. You're speculating that they're at some point going to build a mine. Now, we have some companies that are going in and now starting to build mines. I'm not going to mention them. Most people know who they are. And now the lollipops and unicorns go away because now they're trying to create a real business. And now it has a lot of problems. Well, why are they issuing all this equity? Because they can't get a loan. They wanted to build the mine. And now it's not a hope and a prayer anymore. It's not living on a prayer or lollipops and forecasts of Shangri-La. It's an actual business that has to be judged on the merit of, you know, and it's not easy to build a mine in third world countries. Oops. Plus the fact that we're in a liquidity tightening phase. When that happens, speculative investments are the first thing that go down. Why is this hard? I've been saying this for 2 years. You have to be, what's a burning match? Light a wooden match and hold it. It eventually burns down. That's what most of these companies do. They burn down because they're not ever going to produce a pound of uranium. Okay? They're speculative trading sardines. That's why I told people, if you're going to get into this and you're not somebody that understands speculation and you're not somebody that understands how this works, if you don't understand that these things can fluctuate 50, 75, 90% drawdowns in the context of a bull market, if you didn't understand that, all you had to do is look at the charts from the last previous bull markets. I put them up here. People didn't do that because they had visions of sugar plums. They were speculators and didn't even know it. They thought they were investing. And you're buying, you know, Saskatchewan Moose Pasture Uranium Company that changed its name and was looking for gold or potash in the previous cycles. Now it's looking for uranium on the same moose pasture. You're a speculator. And yes, in a context of liquidity flowing freely and things like that, those things can run. And they did. But now you're talking about real companies now that have to be judged as real businesses. And so Kazatomprom was down a little bit last week because the forecast is not looking good, because it's actually hard to mine. And they have issues with, getting proper sulfuric acid and labor costs going up and every other thing that when you run a business happens. And so the visions of sugar plums have turned to rotten fruit. These things are not going to, these speculations, guys, are not going to go up. Let me say this. You're not going to like it until liquidity. We go to the next liquidity cycle, up cycle, which I don't know when that starts. These things are going to go down. Some are going to go down 90%. Most of them will go down quite a bit. Most of them are down a lot already. If you're just going to put money in the uranium sector, my advice was to buy URNM because it holds mostly Cameco, Kazatomprom, and the Sprott Trust that holds physical uranium. Now, you're not going to get 10. See, everybody thinks they're going to get that 10,000% return, like mega uranium. Not how it works. So anyways, the results are good for this year, but they're not. The forecast is not looking good for next year. They're probably pretty much, if you look at what they're forecasting, pretty much they're going to do what they did this year. And so it's actually positive longer term for the thesis, because the thesis doesn't change, guys. It's just the cyclicality or where you are in the particular cycle and where you are in the liquidity cycle. So remember, like a couple of years ago, the knock on the uranium thesis was, well, Kazatomprom will just flood the market. Well, they can't do that, even if they wanted to, and they don't want to. So anyways, the results are pretty good for 2022. The forecast for next year is not the best. It'll probably be similar to what 2022 did. And so when you look at it, well, it still pays a pretty decent dividend. So if you like dividends, you'll probably do well there. But it's not going to, go up 10,000% or double in the next year. It's probably not going to happen. And again, nothing's really going to happen with a lot of these things in the commodity and resource market until we see the liquidity cycle change from tightening to expansion. Here's some more of their results. You could see like their production was even down in 2022. The reason that their cash flow and earnings were up is because the price of uranium was up. If you look down here and look at their average realized price, with the average weekly spot price. So a lot of their contracts and stuff, if you read through, and you should read through if you're interested, to understand how they price their uranium. But you see, you can have a 3% decline in production. They're forecasting a 1% decline next year. But as long as the price goes up, you still make tons of money. That's the leverage that you have in mining stocks. But again, what's your forecast on where uranium's going? Again, this is multi-year endeavor. And so the pr people will say to me, well, then are you saying we should sell? I think you should do whatever you should do that personally meets your needs. I'm not a trader. I don't trade stocks. I don't catch bottoms and tops. I look for long-term cycles and then I put my money in, okay? And when the thesis changes, I change my view. Again, how many of you guys that are all bitter about uranium, why did you buy the stocks? I'd like to, maybe somebody should volunteer and come on. I'll interview them. The bitter uranium speculator that didn't know what he was doing, and then he can explain to us what his thinking was, or her. It's like when we sold Peabody the other day. Peabody's going to return capital to shareholders. It's probably going to have a high dividend. It's probably going to buy back shares. Is it going to go up 600% from here? Probably not. The thesis I had was to buy it cheap at $4 or $5 a share, which is what we did, and ride it up. That's what we did. Okay, you sell and move on to the next thing, because that's what I'm looking for is capital appreciation. I'm not looking for a dividend stock. So what was your thesis for buying uranium stocks? Did you write it down? Did you have a plan? Did you understand that these things are, most of these things are burning matches? I don't get it. So gold has been running lately because this is what it does. And I think a couple things, I'm going to show you a couple charts here. I do have a couple small positions in some juniors, which I'm getting more and more active in researching. I probably will add a basket of these things to the portfolio just because I think things are looking like they're lining up for a run in gold. This is Ole Hansen. He's one of the guys, I think he's the head investment guy or economist at Saxo Bank over in Denmark. They have a podcast, but I thought this was an interesting, again, these are anecdotal. This could be confirmation bias, but it says gold and Fed funds peaks. It's Fed funds peaks have in the past signaled big gold rallies. So you see previous gold rally in the early 2000s when we had a peak in rates, and then as they cut rates, you see how gold responded. Same thing happened after the last right raise in rates, as they raised rates and then they peaked here. You see gold went up, same thing here, rates peaked and then gold went up. So how close are we to the peak? You have to ask yourself, and is gold ready to make the next run? Again, this could be confirmation bias. This looks like a correlation that has worked in the past. Again, it's probabilities. If this has worked in the past, then we'll look for other correlations or other things that have worked. And what's the setup? What's your risk reward look like if we're close to peaking in rates, which I think we are. You notice that they peaked and then they held them for some period of time and then they have the rate cuts. You see it wasn't that long here in the last rate raising cycle back in 2017, 18 and into 19. But if you think they were going to continue higher, well, then you probably don't want to be buying gold stocks. I think we're closer to the peak than, as like I said, and the reason why is because everything's breaking. So Crescat Capital, go on YouTube. They put in there, they have these like good talks that they give. They're like sometimes they usually do them like once a week or once every other week. And Tavi Costa, and I forget who the other guy is over there. I forget his name. But and they also have a review of different mining stocks that they're particularly Crescat Capital invested. I mean, they do a lot of investing in private placements. They're heavy into resource stocks. And they, if you go back and listen to some of their talks, I mean, they have some of the best macro. Again, it could be confirmation bias because I'm partial to this idea that we're going to have this inflationary bias because of the debts we have. That's kind of their view. And then what does that mean? Well, resources and hard assets are going to do well. But regardless, this is a chart they put up. And what they're talking about here is the gold to S&P ratio, or the gold performance related to S&P after you have a yield curve inversion. Now, what's yield curve inversions? That's when you have, the front end of the curve is trading for more, have a higher rate than the longer part of the curve. And so you've heard about that 2 and 10 year correlation. Well, anyways, but what this chart basically shows is that how gold outperforms once the yield curve is 70% or more inverted. Okay. And we are above, well above that now. And this is what has happened in other periods, like in gold to the blue line, gold to S&P 500 ratio during the 73, 74 recession and tech bust. That was like the Nifty 50 days. You saw what happened. They had, the yellow line is the gold to S&P ratio during all prior times when the yield curve inverted by 70% since 1970. And so here we are here. So this plays out over 2 years, basically, as the yield curve inverts. So what does that mean? Well, that we have a yield curve that's more than 70% inverted right now across the curve. And in the past, what's has, it kind of goes back to this last chart. What happens, right? I mean, the Fed cuts rates and they reliquefy the system, and gold does well in that environment. That's what we're talking about here. So this starting to line up like a setup here, okay? Like we got dealt a decent hand here. And so we have to look at what's the probability? What's the probability that Mr. Powell continues raising rates until he gets inflation down to 2%? Or this is kind of the bet you're making, right? You're betting, that's one bet, that he'll continue raising rates until he gets things down to 2%, irregardless of all the different crises that happen. They continue breaking things, and that he said that they have the tools to deal with that. I don't believe that. The other view is that things are going to break sufficiently that they're going to have to reverse course, and that's what's going to happen. And so this is a bet worth taking. Now, this is just the gold price. This isn't gold shares. Typically what happens during a gold bull market, gold shares will appreciate three, they're leveraged to the gold price for reasons that any mining stock is leveraged to the price of the underlying commodity that they're producing, because they basically, in a lot of cases, have a fixed cost business. And as the price of the material goes up, again, say you're mining gold at, $1,000 an ounce, and you're getting $1,800 an ounce, and say you're making $1 million a year, and then, I've explained this before. Say you got 100,000 ounces of production, the gold price is 1,000, it goes up to 1,100, you're making $1 million, dollars a year. If it goes to 1,200, you just double. They're very leveraged to the gold, to the resource price. You can. That should be easy to understand because your costs don't typically go up, that quickly as like the underlying commodity does when they're in bull markets. And so, this looks like from the historical situation, which they sh if you go back and look at the video, they talk about this and they show that all the time since 1970 this happened. It's pretty highly correlated. So again, we're dealing in probability. So A lot of people have asked me about precious metals and gold, and I wasn't keen to get into it, but it looks like things are setting up now. When I start looking at some of these previous setups, we're kind of in that mode right now. And so that's where I'm looking. And it looks like we're on the front end of this thing. We really haven't even taken off yet. So the yellow line is what typically happens. This was an anomaly where they had the best, and this was just, like I said, the gold price. And so if you just want to buy gold, you'll outperform the S&P over the next, 2 years or so, based on what we think is going to happen or what they think is going to happen. And so why is the opportunity in gold stocks? Well, here again is the gold price in yellow, and here is the TSX Venture Index versus gold. And so what happens is, the TSX Venture Exchange has a lot of junior mining stocks in it, a lot of gold mining stocks, a lot of mining stocks in general. A lot of the uranium stocks trade on the TSX Venture Exchange. And so in the past, we've had correlations, as you can see, with the gold price. I mean, 2008 was obviously a crash, just like this COVID crash. But, as the gold price goes up, typically the TSX Venture Exchange does well also. And so what I wanted to point out here, even though we've had basically, I mean, this is a classic setup of a cup and handle type chart. I mean, everything is lining up for a big move in gold. Again, I've said this tongue in cheek. I think you're going to be shocked at how high the gold price goes and the copper price and the oil price this decade. But basically, we've had multiple years of underperformance in the TSX Venture Exchange related to the gold price. And so what's more likely to happen just based on everything we've been discussing vis-a-vis the Federal Reserve, the economy? Are we going to be more tight or more loose? And like I said, that's a setup for higher gold prices. Then I just can't see the mining shares staying down here. And the thing that the people over at Crescat point out in their videos, because they go over these different mining companies that they're invested in, is that they're proceeding on. I mean, you're buying, in some cases, gold in the ground for pennies on the dollar. Okay. It's a tremendous value. When you actually start and listen to how they explain it and point out specific incidences, and you've got real companies that are out drilling on real properties and coming in with results, and the stock prices go down. I just don't think that's going to stay like that. I think this gap is going to close when we get the next run. When gold breaks above 2000 and stays there and moves higher to 2,500, 3,000, wherever it's going to go in the next run, I think the shares are going to wake up, because it's going to be an area people are going to be looking for alpha, and it's going to be there. So I just wanted to point this out real quick. I'll put a link to the article. This FedNow program, I don't know if it's a precursor to a central bank digital currency, but I don't like the Federal Reserve. I don't want the government involved in everything. They screw up everything they touch. And now, they've got this instant payment system that they're going to be pushing out. Depending on how you think about things, depending on who different opinions you listen to, is this a precursor to a central bank digital currency? Is this a step on the way? I don't know. But I don't see this being like promulgated throughout the financial media. No one's talking about this, right? And so basically, I'll put a link to the article. It says the first week of April, the Federal Reserve will begin the formal certification of participants for launch of the service. It's the FedNow service. Early adopters will complete a customer testing and cert program informed by feedback from the FedNow pilot program to prepare for sending live transactions through the system. Here's this geek at the Federal Reserve. He says, quote, "We couldn't be more excited about the forthcoming FedNow launch." Of course not, because you want more control over everything. That's what sociopaths want. "Which will enable every participating financial institution, the smallest to the largest, and from all corners of the country, to offer a modern instant payment solution." See, that's how they're selling all of this. It's just going to be convenient. It's going to reduce friction. And maybe that's the case. I don't know. It goes on to say, "With the launch drawing near, we urge financial institutions and their industry partners to move full steam ahead with preparations to join the FedNow service," unquote. And then this is a little blurb about what this is. The Federal Reserve banks are developing the FedNow service to facilitate nationwide reach of instant payment services by financial institutions, regardless of size or geographic location, around the clock every day of the year. Through financial institutions participating in the FedNow service, businesses and individuals will be able to send and receive instant payments at any time of day, and recipients will have full access to funds immediately, giving them greater flexibility to manage their money and make time-sensitive payments. So I guess I'm agnostic right now, but again, I really don't want them involved in any of this. You could, there's no reason why, you know, this couldn't happen. I think a lot of people are going to say, well, it just reduces friction. It makes things more convenient. That's how all these things all are sold. Okay. They're always sold at some societal benefit. And so I'm looking at how can they use this to get more power? How can they use this to have more control? That's where my bias is, when the federal government or anybody at the Federal Reserve or in these big corporations, you know, we live in a fascist state. We have the large corporations in bed with the federal entities or government entities to control, because having control and pushing out competitors as smaller, more nimble competitors, you know, is beneficial to these large corporations that, you know, give money to politicians so they can run. You know how this works. We've talked about this before. And so I don't know what this means yet. I think it's going to be sold again. It'll be convenience and less friction in the system. And you can do business on Sunday and blah, 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 and Saturday. And we'll see. If you have a view on this, I'd be interested in hearing about it in the comments. Again, there's things happening in the world. I know this is getting a little bit long because I've been droning on, but one of the companies in the portfolio invests in India. It's basically run by a Canadian billionaire. And when I see things like this, I become optimistic, because there's always something positive happening in the world. So you have like India spending big on infrastructure. Look how it's just went completely ballistic over the last 2 or 3 years. In the annual letter to shareholders, this particular company I'm talking about that's in the portfolio, they were talking about how the Indian government under Mr. Modi has basically, you know, they fixed a lot of they went through a big electrification of villages over the last several years. And I didn't realize this, but they have, the thing they've been pushing out recently is this clean water and, you know, treated water to most of the population. These are pretty big deals. I mean, you're talking about, you know, backwards developing country with a lot of issues. And again, this stuff compounds on itself as infrastructure gets better. Efficiencies are taken out of the efficiency is put into the system, right? You don't have as many truck maintenance because you have roads that don't beat up your trucks. You can move goods faster and cheaper. With cleaner water, people can have less sickness and disease, which puts less of a burden on the economy. So you see, all of these things individually may not change things, but they are all incrementally compounding to make things better. So again, things are happening in other places of the world. And this is kind of like, this thing kind of shooting up like this, to me is like, you know, this is why I'm another reason why I'm bullish on resources long term, because the lack of investment. Yet we have a country like India that's kind of entering the time when China was like, you know, 25 years ago, when it was building out its infrastructure and the effect it had on resource markets. Am I saying the same thing is going to happen with India? Well, I don't know, because the Chinese, you know, have a centralized economy, and India doesn't have a centralized economy. So maybe it'll happen slower and over a longer period of time in India, but it is happening. And so I thought this was kind of fun to end this on. Here was a tweet by this Brian Gitt. I follow him on Twitter, and was talking about electrifying the economy of the U.S. and how we have to build out our transmission and distribution to do that. And why, and they were talking about a specific incidents where it took 17 years to get this line approved and built. I mean, it's just, and why is that? Well, because of the pushback for all this development, that people don't want to have it around them. And so he made the statement here: everybody wants electricity, but they don't want power lines built near them. The evolution of opposition to infrastructure, NIMBY, which we're all familiar with, not in my backyard, Then you've heard me mention banana, build absolutely nothing anywhere near anybody. And so the next one is, the new one is nope, not on planet Earth. Now, I think it's tongue in cheek, but I think you get the point. If you want to have an electrified economy, we don't have the infrastructure to do that. So we have to build the infrastructure, yet people don't want the infrastructure around them. So it's kind of a dichotomy that needs to get resolved. Again, another reason why I think fossil fuels will be with us a lot longer than most people think. Okay, guys, that's it for this week. Again, I'll be looking forward to the comments. I know a lot of people have strong opinions on the first slide we talked about. Again, you know, everybody has their view. I have my view. You have your view. We try to encourage dialogue. Let's keep it above board, though. Okay, talk to you next week.